Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What would you do if you came face to face with your former self?
Wow.
Where did you find this?
You'd stop and you'd listen. The highs and lows, fear and faith.
It's amazing.
The moments that change a course of a life.
That was the most uplifting moment of my career.
We call them interventions.
Welcome to Interventions. I'm Kim Taylor Bennett, and I'm a music journalist and producer. Right now I'm in LA, but generally I'm in New York.
I'm Matt Everett. I too am a music journalist and producer, and I'm in London. I'm not in New York, and I'm not in California. More is the pity, to be honest.
This is a new podcast where I guess if I was trying to explain it to someone, I'd say we're going to confront musicians with the most important moments in their lives. So take them back to when they wrote that song, met that person, played that gig, and see how they feel about that time now, from the start of their career all the way to the present day. We'll be meeting people on both sides of the Atlantic, with me in the US and Matt in the UK.
What did you think when we asked you to do this? What was your initial reaction?
I was psyched to be asked to do this because basically the whole reason I got into music journalism, apart from loving music, was because I'm a nosy bitch. So like, I just want to ask all the personal questions, like, who are you writing about here? Like, what deep, dark depression were you in there? What does this lyric mean? You know, like, what childhood trauma did you have that made you become this massive a-hole? You know, like, I just really like asking the difficult questions, and especially like asking them to people whose art I admire. So this is just the dream come true, basically. I'm like, interventions, yes, key points in an artist's life where, you know, it was a turning point, or they were in a dark hellhole and they clawed their way up. Everybody loves a Phoenix Rising story.
Yeah, everybody loves a comeback. I think this is also, by making these interventions, as we're kind of calling them, physical things, making them, here's an object, or here's a direct quote, or here's a photo, or here's a recorded message we've got from somebody in your past, and without warning them about it, which doesn't normally happen in big major interviews, you don't get a chance to surprise big names normally.
Yeah.
Because a lot of big name artist interviews, it can get a bit generic, can't it?
They're just so, I mean, they've just done it so many times before, and it's obviously our job to kind of elicit a different reaction or a different response. So it's exciting to be able to be like, here is this, look at this.
This is the other thing as well. With these stars, these kind of big name people we're going to be speaking to, their lives are very well documented.
Yeah.
So some quote that they made at the start of their career when they're talking about, oh yeah, with every other band is worth nothing, we're the only band that matters. You know, we can take that quote and go, yes, now, 6 albums in, you know, how do you feel about being that precocious young woman or that bold young man, and kind of see how they feel about themselves now.
Totally.
In a kind of different context.
Yeah, I interviewed The Killers not that long ago, and Brandon was having a real kind of, like, he wrote that song, The Man, about how he was as a, like, swaggering 23-year-old taking on the world, and he was a bit embarrassed about like how much braggadocio he had. But I was like, dude, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. You got to be a rock and roll star. You got to be sort of ridiculous so that you can create this myth. And you know, you may be in your late 30s now, but you needed to be doing that when you were 23 for us to believe in you.
Yeah, this is the thing. I think like it's almost like there's no mistakes, because even the things that may seem ridiculous or overblown, or even the things that are like really hard, you know, and a lot of musicians do kind of have crises, and crises of faith or personal and emotional crises, they all still make up the person that you are. Often it goes directly into the work. So it's kind of like all these things, no matter how awful that haircut might be in that photo, or having to think about that moment when, you know, you sold all your possessions for whatever, that all makes you who you are. So yeah, I guess it's probably going to be quite awful for some people. But hopefully, I mean, you know, more interesting than a, like, where did you get your band name from interview.
Oh God, yeah. Ugh. Don't ask that question.
And our first guest on Interventions is from Snow Patrol. It's Gary Lightbody. If I lay here, if I just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world? If you've heard of Snow Patrol, you probably know them for massive, colossal, big indie stadium hits like Run and Chasing Cars. But they, you know, they've actually been going for a very, very long time. There's a band that's got a really interesting history to reach this point of being like these global stars that have just released their seventh album, Wildness.
Yeah, that was wild. When I was thinking about Snow Patrol and researching them, I was like, oh my God, they started in 93. I had, they broke really 10 years later. It's an extraordinarily long amount of time to like hold on to that dream and to keep grafting and being broke and putting out records and like not getting played on the radio. So, I mean, kudos to them.
We talk a bit, as you'll hear, like about when it did hit, I mean, on X Factor 2008, Leona Lewis sung their song Run and like it just became this colossal hit. And, you know, they had Chasing Cars, which was used on Grey's Anatomy. And they kind of went from being this very introspective, very sort of raw emotional band to being like these huge anthems that people just lost their minds for. Once again, that doesn't normally happen. Those kind of bands don't normally cross over in that way, you know? Yeah. It's quite impressive. It really is.
It is impressive. And it's also, the 2000s were an interesting time where it was, you know, for indie rock bands, they were crossing over into the charts. And it's like not so much the case these days. That indie rock felt like the mainstream, and obviously Leona Lewis helped get them right up the charts. But it doesn't feel like bands do that nowadays so much.
Yeah, because they've got the new album's come out. It's called Wildness. Last one before that was 2011. So that's a pretty big gap. And one of the things I wanted to talk to Gary about was like what happened in that space of time. And he talks about having severe writer's block and about how, you know, he's more overindulgent tendencies really derailed him, his songwriting, and really derailed the band as well.
Yeah, they dropped off and I just sort of thought that was it. So it was, I mean, love a comeback story. I was like, oh, it was kind of awesome. They're back.
Let's do Gary. Welcome to Interventions, Gary Lightbody.
Hi, Matt. How's it going?
It's going very well.
Excellent.
Do you do any preparation before, if someone says, oh, you're going to do a podcast interview? Do you?
Not when it's people I know, like right. Yourself. I figure that we're going to have a conversation and it's going to be fun and I trust you. So, okay. You know, like, I know you're not going to like...
Try.
It's probably going to be okay.
Well, yeah, this is... I mean, interventions are normally when you present someone with maybe the terrible things they've done throughout their life, and you sit down and...
I'm okay with that as well.
And you go back over that. But in this case, we're going to be looking at a kind of key important moments and people and quotes and photographs and music that kind of have made up your life and career to this point.
Okay.
Does that sound all right?
Sounds good. Let's do it.
First thing we're going to look at, early press review.
Oh, farts.
It's a podcast. You can say, oh, fuck, if you want.
Oh, fuck, then. I'll recant my first farts and I'll raise you a fuck.
Do you remember reading the very first review that you got?
I'm not sure. I've definitely read... I used to read reviews back in the early days, as everybody that's ever been in a band does in the early days. And then there is a point where you just stop. And I'm, you know, long past the last time I read a review. But yeah, I remember reading some early ones. I'm not sure the one that you're about to show me, but I did read some.
This is from the Times.
This is 2017.
This is the Times, so this is...
Okay. The London Times? The Times of London?
The actual Times.
Right.
March 2001.
Okay.
Snow Patrol, one night is not enough. What promises to be more intolerable fey whining from Belle and Sebastian's label mates turns out to be a pleasingly steely tale of heartbreak and masochism, reminiscent of Leonard Cohen's First We Take Manhattan. That's good.
Wow.
Still, you can almost see their sad and lonely bedsit complete with congealed washing up in the sink.
How they knew me.
Well, the thing I like about this is now we're looking back on this as a new record's coming out and you've had a certain amount of success. So there was a little bit of, everything turned out okay. Do you remember that one?
No, don't remember that one. Back when people wrote single reviews.
How much did you care early on about that kind of stuff?
Oh, I cared. I cared a lot. It broke my heart when we got a bad review. So my heart was broken pretty much constantly.
Are there any that particularly that still haunt you to this day?
No, but the funniest one we ever got was in the NME. It wasn't a review as such. It was the end of year review. And it was talking about the flooding, as there always is in a year in Britain, like referring to the flooding. And it said, we had to cancel a part of our tour. And it said, flood levels rose as a nation wept. That was the best line. I mean, obviously it stinks a bit, but at the same time, it is absolutely hilarious. And when it's funny, you go, fair play.
Yeah.
You can't say anything about that. It's when it's personal, that's when it stings. And that's why eventually you realize there's no point in reading any of it.
But did you have a bedsit complete with congealed washing up in the sink?
Yeah, I wouldn't have used the word congealed, but yes.
Paint me a picture of that if I was to visit your bedsit in 2000.
Well, funny, 2001 was, that was the year that our second album came out and we got dropped from Jeepster actually as well. And it was also the year that I wrote Run.
A mixed bag.
But Run obviously didn't come out until 2003 when we released Final Straw for the first time. And I say the first time because we re-released it in January 2004, and that's when it took off. But 2001, it was a flat with Nathan Connolly, our guitar player, and Jimmy Symington, an old school friend, and his girlfriend. So it was the four of us, and it was mayhem. We had a lot of parties, and the place was just a chaos pit. There was a lot of. I wasn't very tidy. That's to say the least. I was an extremely messy person at the time. I'm really not anymore.
Really? That shifted?
It shifted, yeah. I became kind of, I'm not sure if it shifted, it might have shifted too far. I'm a little OCD now, but I was slovenly, to say the least. And it was in that environment that I wrote Run. And I hate to demystify a song here that probably means something to some people, but Light Up, obviously is the chorus. The electricity had just gone off. So I'm not 100% sure whether it was, whether I was referring to that or not, but it was definitely present in my mind at the time. It was those electricity cards when you you'd always be in the minus numbers, mm-hmm. and it would always be going double speed.
You'd always be overdraft.
Your brain, like you never got with the fact that if you just kept it above that line, it would cost you less.
No.
You would always be in the emergency fund.
That's the little bit of the rebel in you, isn't it? When you're in limited circumstances, you can't really stick it to the man, but you can
stick it to yourself.
You can see you still run the overdraft on the Lecky key.
Yeah.
Interventions with Snow Patrol's Gary Lightbody.
Okay, let's do a photograph. Because obviously this is a podcast. Describe this beautiful photo that I've just handed you. Intervention number two, I guess.
Oh my good God.
Oh, you look good.
That shirt does not, though. But that's a difficult, an interesting choice for a shirt. 2001, something like that.
2000, I think, but yeah.
So that's me. on the right, and that's Mark McClelland in the middle, and that's Johnny Quinn looking very handsome at the back. I'm not sure why the most handsome person in the band is at the back out of focus, but here we are.
Was and
also, also, the shot is taken by Bradley Quinn, which is Johnny's brother, so I'm not sure if he's paying back for, you know, all the Chinese burns and wedgies over the years, but here we are.
Would you call it a prison haircut?
Yeah. I used to shave my head pretty close to the skin back in those days. I'd grow it really long, and then I'd dye it. I'd bleach it. And then I dye it different colours. And then when I caught myself in the mirror, I would go, I'm going to shave that off. And so that was the pattern. I would repeat that pattern until ad nauseum, really.
How do you feel looking at that picture? Because, I mean, you look young. I mean, you don't, it's not like you look old now. Let's be honest.
Thank you. But yeah, I do look a little younger. It's not a bad picture. I'll give you that. You could have picked a lot worse.
Yeah.
And I appreciate, I'm sure you found a lot worse than I appreciate.
Yes.
Not again. I'm very grateful that you picked that one.
Is there a point where you, because you see it with some bands, it tends to be like the sort of stadium rockers, they work out what their face is, and that's the face they do in like nearly all their press photos. I don't think you've quite worked out your face
yet. No, I haven't really got a face. It's sort of shop display mode, really, isn't it? I'm still figuring that out. Yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Put the headphones on for intervention number three.
So I first met him in September 1990, and he was in my fourth form English class. And he was just
this?
Very likable, very
Did
personable,
you interview him?
Quite laid back, God quite happy go lucky chap. Clearly very bright, but like many boys, happy to sort of go along with an economy of effort. He wasn't putting all of his hard work in the school. As an English teacher, I'm proud to tell you that I introduced him to, Seamus Heaney would be the main one, I suppose. Probably James Joyce. As his English teacher, I probably shouldn't have been teaching him about Van Morrison and Bob Dylan, but I think they probably had as big an influence. It was quite clear that there was something that had just clicked into place.
And who was that?
That was Mr. Mark McKee from Campbell College, Belfast. I was there between 89 and 94, and he was my English teacher for my last 2 or 3 years there. Extraordinary man.
Tell me a bit about the kind of impact he had on you.
So, I mean, he describes it beautifully there, but he was one of those teachers. It was very much like, oh, captain, my captain. You know, he was that teacher, the teacher that called you to arms, you know, and myself and Davey Matchett, who actually we were part of the team that set up the Oh Yeah Music Centre in Belfast, and we also run a company back home, an artist development company called Third Bar. Together, we were in his English class together. So his impact went right, it wasn't just me, there was a lot of people that ended up doing things from that class in the arts and gave their lives to making, trying to make art or trying to help people make art. So he had a massive impact. And he was just an extraordinary, extraordinary man. Just his classes were always really fun. I always looked forward to them. He introduced me to Seamus Heaney, as he said there. And Seamus Heaney became very quickly a hero and still is of mine. And he was the reason why I started writing in the first place. I started writing poetry. I was a published poet, age 15. Terrible, terrible poetry. But
really terrible?
Pretty bad, yeah. Pretty bad. Mostly about the troubles in Northern Ireland. You know, I didn't really know how to process it. I wasn't on one side or the other. I felt very isolated and, you know, outside of what was going on in Northern Ireland. I just wanted everybody to get along. So I was a very sensitive kind of kid. And so I wrote a lot about that. And
what kind of a student were you?
I was a terrible student. Terrible student all the way through university. I ended up getting a degree, but I was never as engaged in school or studies as I was in music.
We have a question from him.
Yes, ask him what he's reading at the moment and if he would recommend it. That'd be a good question. I struggle to know. Gary invites me to concerts all the time, and it's very kind of him. You know, every time he's at home, he texts me and says, "Would you like to come along?" What do you buy a man who has everything? So the only thing I'm proud of, I once found him a copy of a poetry anthology which had actually gone out of print, because I thought it was something that he would really enjoy. So ask him if he's reading poetry or if he's reading a novel and if he would recommend it. That's my question for him.
What are you reading?
I am just finished reading, and it came out a couple of years ago and I missed it. A friend of mine bought it for me. Grief is the Thing with Feathers. It just blew me away. It's an extraordinary book about loss, about bereavement, about the family coping with the loss of a mother. It's actually kind of moving to even talk about it. But it's a beautiful book. Lines that just have universes in them, you know, it's beautiful.
Is there a book in you?
Maybe. I've tried to sit down and write one many times. I just don't. I think writing songs, even though, geez, it takes me years sometimes these days, as the last 7 years is attested to, I think that writing songs has removed that longevity of sitting down and writing, you know, because I'm so used to like being done. And with a book, you're never done. I have a friend who's a novelist. And he just got his first book published. It took 6 months of intensive writing, secluding himself from the world. He tells a great story of going. He went to the Irish Aran Islands. There's a Scottish Aran Islands and an Irish Aran Islands, and he went there. And there's only a post office and a pub and a store, and that's it. And there's, you know, a handful of people live there. And in the pub, he would go in and he would order tea with no milk, and on the island he became known as, "Oh, hello, there's no milk." It's the most beautiful thing I think I've ever heard. You're just known as it's your peccadillo is your,
that's the thing, your, that's the one thing about you.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
When you just hear that, how do you feel? So there it is. That's the point it changed.
That is when it changed. That
that piece of music, does it still?
Yeah.
Does it still matter? Yeah,
people talk about Chasing Cars, which you know obviously went on to be our biggest song and is extremely important and we love it to bits. But that for me, Run will always be the most important song we ever did.
Well, was there the moment when there must be an amazing feeling, just that moment of like, this is it, here it is, it's happening. We can all sense that this thing that we've been talking about, that we believe is possible, this is it, it's happening right now.
Yeah, it's funny because there was that moment. We'd released Final Straw in 2003 to some acclaim. Actually, it was probably our best reviewed record. And then the same amount of sales as the first two albums, really, which was about 15,000 copies. And then Joe Wiley played Run, all 6 minutes of the album version, on Daytime Radio 1 in December. And we went from playing a gig in gig in High Wycombe, the White Horse in High Wycombe, to 15 people, seven of which were in the support band. And that was December 2003. And then Joe Wiley played Run on Radio 1 Daytime, the album version. And, you know, as legend goes, you know, the phone lines melted and everybody wanted to hear it. And so we re-released it, an edited version of it, in January 2004. And we re-released the album. And the album went in number three, which was, you know, we'd never even gone in the top 100. And the single, well, this is to answer your question, we were listening to the charts and Radio 1 and, you know, the countdown. And a friend of mine, Simon Cull, who, thank you so much, Simon, for all those years of Let Me Sleep on Your Couch. I basically slept on friends' couches in those days. He had a party for about 30 or 40 people. And we listened to the countdown, and every time we weren't on it, people cheered, you know, like, and next up, whoever it was, it's not us. Yay. It means we're higher up. And then number five, new entry this week, Snow Patrol with Run. And, you know, the place went mental and we drunk wouldn't have been champagne. We wouldn't be able to afford that cider probably. And that was the moment that was like, oh, things are changing. I mean, it was not the moment probably that everything had changed immeasurably and everything was going to be all right from then on. But it was the moment that we went, oh, this is the first time this door is opened. We can see inside the gilded room.
You know, it's amazing you chose a Leona Lewis cover.
And it's funny, we did sport. I did Sport Relief with Johnny McDade. It was the first thing back that we'd done live TV. We did it. I didn't sing it very well. I was kind of disappointed with my performance because I was so nervous because we hadn't done a live show in 7 years, live TV show in 7 years. But afterwards, there was so much to people were showing me like on their Twitter. There be dragons. I don't go there after a performance, but people are going, everyone's talking about Leona Lewis. I'm like, so everyone has said, what are Snow Patrol doing a Leona Lewis cover for them?
Really?
Yes.
Genuinely.
Yeah. And, you know, Leona Lewis had our own one and only number one hit. So I have to be very grateful for that because we had never had a number one single. And, but she got Run to number one. So.
Thank you, Leona.
Thank you very much, Leona, indeed.
Interventions with Snow Patrol's Gary Lightbody.
If we're talking about being back, I mean, there is no denying 2011 to 2018, that is a gap.
Yes.
That is a certain amount of time. Was there a point in that when it was like, I don't think there is going to be another record. I don't think I do want to or can.
Yeah.
Do this.
Yeah, many times.
Really?
Yeah. There was a lot of times I thought, I'm never going to be able to write another song for Snow Patrol. I don't know how. I was writing songs for TV, for movies, for other people, for no problem. And every time I sat down to write a song for Snow Patrol, it just seemed to hurt.
What do you mean?
I didn't understand how to write from... I wasn't connected to myself anymore. I was drinking way too much. I was very depressed. I was very kind of just disjointed, I guess. It took a long time to figure out that I needed to pack all that in before I could get any kind of clarity. But I didn't realize even that at the time, that was going to bring a new Snow Patrol record with it. I was just doing it because I was in a dark place.
How difficult was it to stop? Because I think for bands, you know, if it's booze, you're used to have a couple of pints before sound check, do sound check, have a couple of drinks afterwards, do a gig, drink whatever. That's what happens when you start from the age of 18 or whatever.
Yeah,
that's
no,
your daily routine.
Yeah. Mine was worse off tour because I didn't drink that much on tour because my voice would take a beating. I realized after about 2007, I lost my voice in Houston, Texas. Sounds like the start of a country song, but I went to see a vocal coach for the first time. Band had been together for 15 years at that time or something, but went to see a vocal coach, and always seemed like cheating to me or something.
Yeah.
First of all, I had polyps, which I had to take a month off rest and stuff. And then I went to see a vocal coach, and they gave me some warm ups, and basically told me that, you know, what's your routine before a gig? And I was like, well, you know, involves beer and sometimes vodka or whatever. But they were like, yeah, well, you know, that's your problem right there. So I would not drink before shows or even after shows unless I had a day off the next day.
Right.
So it wouldn't be a lot of drinking on tour for me after that point. But when I went off tour, that's when I would drink. I'd make up for all the drinking that I'd missed out on. FOMO. So I basically, so then the fact the album took so long, it was kind of like it was a self fulfilling prophecy in a way. I was drinking too much, and the album was being delayed, and because the album was being delayed, I was drinking more, and it just became this sort of self-perpetuating kind of thing, or a snake eating its own tail or whatever. But I once I quit 2 years ago, I started to come out of the fog of that, and everything became very clear.
And how did that feel, finishing the first song that you were like, that's not for a film, that's not for an ad, that's not for someone else, that's...
It was Don't Give In.
Yeah.
And it was celebratory, to say the least. I'm not sure I'd ever felt quite like it before, because I'd never been that present when something was finished, to actually know that something was finished, know that something was ready, and then not go out celebrated by getting hammered and waking up the next day and feeling rotten. So it was a very different experience from then on in, where you actually were very tuned in to everything that was happening.
Here it is. This is it. There's the record. There's Wildness in your hands, looking at that physical object.
Yeah. It's been the biggest labor of love I've ever embarked on. Yeah. Never been more proud of anything.
Thank you very much. It's been really good to speak to you, mate.
Thanks, Matt. Shit.
Now you've heard the interview, what do you think about him? What do you think about the chat?
I mean, I thought he was so charming, you know, very self-deprecating, has a great sense of humor. And, you know, the end of it, you guys, he got emotional, and I was really, I was really pretty touched by that. Like, he's obviously been through the ringer and come out the other side, and he has finally produced a record, and he's just like, shit, I did it.
Yeah, I think there was. It's interesting because, you know, he's really funny, as you say. He's self-deprecating, and you kind of wonder how much of that is, you know, that's it's true. It's not a false thing, but it is. It's there alongside this kind of, you know, obviously it's like 7 years of not doing a record, not being able to write. It's pretty difficult for anyone. I was surprised by how emotional he got. I was kind of stunned by that, and quite how honest he was about the drinking, you know?
You know what? It's a really wonderful thing to make art that touches people, and it's a wonderful thing to put your heart and soul into that art. And I think it's that exchange of emotion is really what makes the world go round. Have you, from the first time that you interviewed him to now, did you notice a difference, or was he just pretty much the same kind of dude?
He seems pretty much the same. I think I know that when they first got very, very famous, I think there was definitely an intent to try and stay normal. I think there was some bands do that. Some bands have this thing. It's like, okay, we will, as we've been, we haven't been successful for so many years. Now we are. We're going to try and hang on to the things that stop us from turning into egomaniacal idiots. Mm. And I think there was that, keep the humour, try to keep your feet on the ground. Don't turn up with 18 people in your entourage.
Yeah.
And I think there was a conscious effort to do that, which I think has served him well. But, there's no roadmap for that kind of stuff. When you get that big, the only people that can tell you what it's like are people that have been there before. And even in their case, every band, every artist, every director, every film star, it's different for everybody. And I don't think necessarily it's suited to people, even people that go hunting for it. That's fair?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think with artists who have incredible ambitions and they're chasing something, and then often when they get there, they're so isolated that they're just like, okay, now I'm here and I have the mansion and I have the success and I'm sort of not fulfilled. And then you're really just like alone with yourself. And I think that can be hard. That can be really hard.
That'd be great as well. At the same time, I'd love the mansion. I'd love to have some quiet time just on myself with my 80-foot guitar-shaped marble swimming pool. That's fine. I could deal with the loneliness. It doesn't bother me.
It's not true. Everybody needs a cuddle, Matt.
Yeah, okay. We should really say thank you to Gary. And obviously, as we talked about, the new Snow Patrol album, Wellness, is out now, and you can hear it. All the stuff we've been talking about, you can hear all the music that he's kind of done, that Gary's created and written after this slow, difficult birth. It's on all streaming services as we speak, and in fact, you can hear all of Snow Patrol's considerable back catalogue and past albums right up there as well.
So thank you, Gary, for being so candid and lovely. If you want to find out more about the band, you could go to snowpatrol.com or at snowpatrol on Instagram to just be very voyeuristic. And Twitter should do the trick also. You can chat with them there.
That's it. That was the first episode of Interventions with Gary Lightbody from Snow Patrol.
We're going to be doing more of these. We're going to be going deep. I'm really excited about this series. And if you haven't subscribed already, then please do. I'm Kim Taylor Bennett.
And I'm Matt Everett. Thank you very much for listening. This has been a Cup and Nuzzle production in partnership with Globe Productions.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.